friends and colleagues, and welcome to episode 108 of Dermasphere, the podcast by dermatologists, for dermatologists, and for the dermatologically curious. I am one of your hosts. My name is Luke Johnson. I am a pediatric dermatologist and general dermatologist with the University of Utah. And joining me, of course, is...
This is Michelle Tarbox. I'm an associate professor of dermatology and dermatopathology at Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in beautiful, sunny Lubbock, Texas.
And joining us as well is the Pimping Bell. Say hello, Pimping Bell. The Pimping Bell exists to highlight especially question-worthy or noteworthy content, so especially if you are in an academic program in any capacity, you want to pay attention when the bell rings. Our mission here on Dermasphere is to bring you discussions of some of the latest research in the world of clinical dermatology so that you can free up some of your day to pay more attention to your patients or whatever else you got going on. A couple announcements before we get into it. As before, the Dermatology Echo from the University of Utah is still rolling along. We'd love to see you guys there. It's one Friday every month. There's some free CME. There's a short, like 15 to 20 minute lecture from one of our faculty. You can present some of your patients. We'd love to see you there. Check out the link in the show notes. Also, there are a couple meetings in Idaho outside of Sun Valley, which is this beautiful mountain biking place, in September, the Intermountain Dermatology Society meeting, as well as the Practical Dermatology for Primary Care meeting, of which I am the director, co-director, bring myself down a little bit. So we'd love to see you there as well. Check the show notes. And finally, we have some video content now available. It's our discussions that we have on the podcast, but with some graphics and PowerPointy stuff. They're on ViewMedi, V-U-M-E-D-I. So create an account, log in, check us out. And while you're there, there's lots of other cool videos to see. Good news, everybody. Steve Feldman is back in the house. Hello, Steve Feldman. Yay. Woo! Dr. Feldman, you've been here a lot now, but you might be sick of introducing yourself, but some of our listeners might still not know who you are.
Hey, I'm Steve Feldman from Wake Forest University, where I've been on the faculty here for like, I don't know, a long time, 30-something years.
And you've got a number of areas of expertise, including behavioral economics, which is one of the fields I find very fascinating, especially when it comes to, honestly, just living my everyday life, but also taking care of my patients. You've got a book about it called An Illustrated Dictionary of Behavioral Economics for Healthcare Professionals. Friends, you can find this on Amazon, and we've been using it as a bit of a roadmap to just talk about some of the concepts in behavioral economics.
You know, my PhD is in protein chemistry. And the way I, got into behavioral economics is just, you know, stealing things from other researchers on weird things the humans, weird ways the humans think, and trying to incorporate those into getting patients better treatment outcomes. I steal things sort of way Led Zeppelin stole stuff from other songwriters.
Well, today we're going to talk about chapter 6, the default option. Tell me about the default option, guys.
Yeah, humans are lazy. The human brain does not want to be bothered. And so there's this enormous inertia and this tendency to go along with the flow. I think decision-making is actually difficult for the brain. Probably if you have to make a lot of decisions, your brain probably just overheats, you know, from all the energy utilization trying to make those decisions. I think this is why they said Obama had like all suits of the same color. There's no decision making involved when he woke up in the morning, just threw the same stuff on every day. Mm-hmm. The default option is the standard thing that you're going to do unless you make a conscious decision to do something other than the default.
I like that.
Like putting on the same suit.
Mm-hmm. Or the same black mock turtleneck.
Yeah. You know, Luke, I have a sense that you probably have a lot of different kinds of clothes in your closet. You might have a lot of trouble deciding, well, gee, should I wear this shirt, that shirt? It might be hard. I find myself, I actually am blessed with a closet full of different stuff, and sometimes it's hard to decide, well, which of these bow ties do I want to put on today?
Interesting that you mentioned this as a specific example, because I actually have a method where I just pick the one that's on the far left, and then after it gets washed, it goes into the far right. So they just sort of march along, and that's how I decide what clothes to wear.
That's
you set up
beauty.
A default. Yeah, you set up a default for which bow tie that allows you to provide variety to your wardrobe. Well done. I take the much lazier course, which is that the university I work at allows us to wear scrubs whenever we feel like it. So I just have a bunch of matching pairs of scrubs, and I just, whichever one has a pair that is clean, I put on. And when I'm down to the one that has a red scrub top and a hot pink scrub bottom, which I call my Valentine scrubs, I'm like, well, this is obviously laundry day. I apologize for the eyesore I'm presenting you with this morning.
Well, the default option is one of the best examples in sort of, I guess I won't call it popular culture, but that I've heard about in other aspects of academia when it comes to behavioral economics being able to make a difference on a grand scale. There are a couple of specific options. For example, when a large company or even a government that employs people creates a default option, the default is that you contribute a portion of your income to your retirement account. Way more people contribute to their retirement account. And if a country makes it a default option to donate your organs, if you're, you know, killed in a car crash or something, then way more people donate their organs. I think in your book, it cites that the kidney donation rate increased by 86% in, I think, Belgium after they made it an opt-out instead of an opt-in. So if the default option is that you donate your organs, you have to opt out to not do it. And people apparently just don't care enough to check a box. And so they donate their kidneys and save people's lives.
Yeah, this is a powerful effect. I think companies really do care about their employees. They want them to have a decent retirement. They'll match, they'll give them free money, you know, to match the retirement contributions the employee makes. And yet, if the employee has to check a box saying they want to make those contributions and get that free money, they don't do it. They don't make the decision to. But if the default box says you're going to get the free money unless you check here to say I don't want it, then they take the money. It's people. And when I heard this, I was like, oh, this is going to be good, because, you know, you got some of these patients and you give them a few options and they're like, I don't know which I want to do. Let's talk about this and stuff. And then it could take up a lot of your time and it's difficult for them. It would be so much easier if you just said to him, to patients like that, well, this is what we normally do in this situation, but you have these other options. And then people, it makes it very easy for them to go with the normal option. I don't know if I've ever done it, but I thought that if I really wanted to make this a powerful effect, what I would do is I would tell them, in this situation, we normally do this, but you have these other 37 options. There's a lot of options that you have. I'm going to go get a couple textbooks for you to read, and then come back carrying Yorizo and Bologna and Yorizo's, you know, two volume set, and just start walking towards them and say, this is what I need you to look at, you know, to help you make these decisions. And they'd be like, no, that's okay, Doc. I don't need to look at that. We'll just go with that default option.
Well, it makes a lot of sense, because a lot of these things, like which retire or not retirement, but like which insurance plan do you pick, especially if you're not medical at all. And even those of us who are, you're like, geez, I don't know. There's so many moving parts here. It's almost like it doesn't matter. You could pick one and you have just as much chance of being right as if you went with the default. So why bother spending the mental energy?
Yeah, this comes up in my life most commonly with trying to decide where to go to dinner with my wife, because there's so many options. And we're going to starve to death because we can't choose.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, people need to go visit you at Wake Forest, then. Apparently there's a really good restaurant scene out there. So in terms of using this in our patients, I like the idea of sort of this is what we normally do in this circumstance, but also give them some amount of agency to choose to leverage the IKEA effect that we talked about last time. So if they feel like they were actively involved in making the decision, even if they just defaulted to the normal option, then perhaps they're more likely to go with it as well. I use this in my eczema patients, I would say, most commonly, because there's sort of the standard approach, and I sort of lay it out for them, and I say, this is what we normally do. It works for almost all of my patients. I really think it'll work for her, but you know, give me a call in 2 weeks if it's not working.
Yeah, I wonder if doing it that way is almost, you're presenting people with a statistic. Oh, I've got a lot of patients who did well. If you'd have been better off saying, you know, I had one patient that was just like your daughter, and she did really well on this regimen. I think that use the salient approach that we've talked about before. Maybe we could even combine such of these approaches. You know, the standard approach, in this situation, we normally do it this way. And in fact, I had another patient that you reminded me of who did really well with this approach. But then there's countless other ways to do it. And I have these books over here on some of these other approaches. And you could try, let me let you read some of this stack of material. You know,
just I'll be have back a stack in an hour.
Of loose papers, yeah. I'll give you back. I'll let you take these home. And no, please, no.
What would you usually do in this circumstance? And sometimes patients will tell you what they want too, because they'll be like, well, you're the doctor, I trust you. I feel like they're saying, tell me what you want to treat me with. Whereas the ones that have like the skepticalness about, they want to ask every question about everything, that might be the person that would benefit best from the, we're going to let you design your own treatment plan here. Here are your options for your topical. Here's your options for your cleanser. Here's your systemic. Pick these, you know.
When companies were, you know, felt bad that the employees weren't taking the free money, weren't funding their accounts, they thought, oh, let's give them more choices. That'll help.
Oh, no.
And that found that it made it worse. They found that it made it worse. So, mm-hmm. You know, just giving people this overwhelming other options can help guide them to the one you want them to do.
That makes
sense. And if anyone else out there making decisions about how to structure patient forms or making decisions about your formulary or even, you know, at a local or state level, that's where this can really come in. So, like, people have to opt out of HIV testing in particular situations, for example, is one that's come up before. So keep it in mind, the default option is powerful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And sometimes that default option is going to be the doctor, what do you recommend? Like the patient might take that as the default too. There's a lot of power in that for a lot of patients. Now, there's some people who are going to read every package insert and then demand 2 hours of your time as you exhaustively try to take them through the part of medical school that they need to understand the information they're trying to digest. But some patients really just genuinely want our best perception of what would be the right treatment for them. And, you know, I think that power of default is significant.
Well, Steve, you are our default behavioral economics expert, so thanks for coming on the show again. I know people can find your book on Amazon, and you're hanging out at Wake Forest eating at a bunch of fancy restaurants, or maybe just the same one every time because it's just too hard to decide. And people can find your work on PubMed, and we'll catch you another time real soon, I'm sure. Thanks again very much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you so much for being a part of this. We really appreciate it. Well, the default option for the news/publication cycle is typically that we publish an article in our literature and a news outlet picks it up and then talks about it. This particular article that I'm going to present next actually is a bit of an inversion of that paradigm. This is a publication that actually came from a case that was publicized, and then patients' families who had similar experiences contacted the medical center so that they could help expand the information around this relatively rare condition. So this is an article I'm going to subtitle Nightmare Fuel, but it is Severe Acute Respiratory Failure in Healthy Adolescents Exposed to Trimethoprim Sulfamethoxazole. So this is yet another reason to give Bactrim a bit of epic side eye whenever you're choosing it, because it is a tricky, tricky drug, and it does a lot of strange things. Importantly, this article was published in 2019, so this was pre-pandemic. It was published in June of 2019, so pretty much no chance that this ARDS that these teenagers were presenting with had something to do with the COVID virus. The chief authors are Jenna O. Miller and Jennifer L. Goldman, and this is published in the Journal of Pediatrics. The institution was UKMC, so University of Missouri, Kansas City. I guess it's just UMKC. I always say that wrong. University of Missouri, Kansas City, Children's Mercy Hospital, and Clinics, Kansas City, Missouri. So pulmonary toxicity has been described to be induced by trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole. The disease process is poorly understood. The authors here present five previously healthy adolescent patients who developed ARDS after taking Bactrim. Four out of five of them actually required ECMO, extracorporeal membrane oxygen support. And unfortunately, two of these teenagers died as a subsequent sequela of this presentation. All of the children required a tracheostomy, and all cases were complicated by pneumothoraces and pneumomediastinum. And four out of five of the children were given the Bactrim for treatment of their acne vulgaris. So this is a medication we sometimes reach for when we have recalcitrant acne in teenage patients. And it's one of all our alternatives to Accutane or doxycycline as an antimicrobial therapy.
Well, I don't reach for it. I feel like most dermatologists don't reach for it because we're terrified that trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole is going to give our patients SJS. We're probably overly terrified about that, but not terrified enough about this because I didn't know it existed. I think, not to lay the blame solely at the fate of PCPs, but I feel like it's mostly primary care doctors who prescribe Bactrim for acne and not so much dermatologists.
Bactrim is also a favored medication in acute care settings because it has very good bioavailability and broad antimicrobial activity. So it has a lot of appealing aspects as an antimicrobial, but as we know, we see it causing things like SJSTEN. And then this is another thing to be aware of if you're prescribing this medication, to let patients know that if they develop pulmonary symptoms, they need to take them seriously.
Yeah, I think it's a good medicine for not acne. Like community-acquired MRSA, this one plus doxy and Clinda are the things that work. So it's got its role for sure. I don't think it's good for acne.
Yeah, I think we have a lot of other opportunities with acne that can hopefully help us avoid this medication when it's not necessary, because it is associated with these idiosyncratic adverse drug reactions. A lot of people believe that these are related to abnormalities of metabolism and may be the result of haptenization of the drug onto native proteins. Bactrim has been implicated in pulmonary reactions, including interstitial lung disease, fibrinous pneumonia, and pneumonitis. The diagnosis of these drug reactions is based on excluding other etiologies, the close timing of drug exposure, and in some cases, but not in this series, recurrence of the symptoms with reintroduction of Bactrim. All of these children were profoundly ill, and no one in their right mind would give them Bactrim a second time just to see if that was actually the causative agent, because they had full-blown ARDS. So these patients were all presenting with acute respiratory failure at different academic centers across the United States after having between 10 and 25 days of Bactrim. All of the patients required invasive respiratory support. Four out of five needed ECMOs, we talked about earlier. In each case, extensive evaluation could not reveal any other etiology of the ARDS in these otherwise healthy adolescents. And the Bactrim exposure, pulmonary evaluation, and clinical course is detailed in the paper. I'm not going to go patient by patient through the characteristics, but I'll summarize some of the common findings. And I also think that the way that this article came to fruition is somewhat fascinating. So the patients were identified when the story of one of the patients was published in a national news outlet about a case of ARDS in this otherwise healthy female patient who was hospitalized and who was actually featured ambulating on the video while she was on ECMO therapy. And so the first author, Dr. Miller, was contacted by four additional patients or family members of the other patients in this case series to help expand our understanding of this entity. So the patients ranged in age from 13 to 18. Four of them were female, one was male. Four of them were treated with Bactrim for acne. One was being treated for a UTI, and they had between 10 and 25 days of drug exposure. In three of the patients, they presented initially to an emergency center and were kind of diagnosed as probably having a viral upper respiratory infection, given sort of supportive treatment and sent home. And then they re-presented within usually a day or so or 2 days with accelerated worsening of the symptoms and then an accelerated course that involved admission to an intensive care unit and invasive respiration for all of the patients. All of the patients were either considered for or actually listed for organ transplantation because their respiratory failure and organ failure was so severe. Some of the patients recovered, some of them did not, two of the patients died. Now, I think kind of common features that are important to emphasize with this is that these were all previously healthy children that didn't have a prior history of pulmonary disease. They developed relatively protean symptoms. Protean is one of those words I love to use. It means the ability to change frequently or rapidly. That would kind of be indicative initially of just any kind of viral upper respiratory, so pharyngitis, cough, dizziness, shortness of breath, or chest pain. But then those symptoms accelerated in several of these patients. And so I think this article reveals to us an important thing if we are going to use Bactrim to counsel patients that if they develop any kind of respiratory compromise, they need to stop the medication and get a medical attention urgently, because the patients can deteriorate quite rapidly. And the pneumothoraces and pneumomediastinum that were common in all of these patients could be fatal if that occurred outside of a medical care center. Now, some of those could be sequela of the invasive respiration that the patients had to go through, but it's also possible that some modifying aspect of the pulmonary infiltrate causes problems with these. The way that they looked at these patients to determine if it was likely that the Bactrim had caused the problem was something called the Naranjo causality assessment tool for adverse drug reactions. And this is a mathematical tool that helps you to derive the probability that a medication is the causative agent for a presentation. So I'm going to ding for that Naranjo causality assessment tool. And the patients that were assessed in this review were all assessed as having a probable indication of the Bactrim causing the adverse events. There have been, of course, previous reports of Bactrim causing pulmonary toxicity. These have all generally been in adult patients and have ranged from inflammation in the lung parenchyma, pleura, airways, mediastinum, or pulmonary vasculature. Some patients have presented with pulmonary fibrosis, and other patients have presented with pulmonary failure. Eosinophilia is common in these patients. The bronchial alveolar lavage samples in some of the patients represented in the literature is positive for eosinophils. In these patients, only two of the patients had eosinophils on their bronchial alveolar lavage, but the timing of the lavage was kind of variable amongst the patients, so they weren't certain if that had a relationship to the tissue eosinophilia. And there have also been biopsies of lung tissue in patients with presenting illness of Bactrim-induced lung disease that have shown tissue eosinophilia, potentially connecting the medication to that presentation. The literature also has case reports of patients who've had reappearance of symptoms of lung disease on reintroduction of the drug. That was not done with any of these patients because they were far too ill to consider that. The pathophysiology we don't completely understand, but again, we think it might have to do with defective drug metabolism, the formation of reactive intermediate species that can bind to proteins and then cause an immunologic effect. The patients were treated with a lot of supportive therapies as well as immunosuppressive therapies to help decrease the inflammation that was occurring in their lungs and give them back some pulmonary function. This, I think, highlights a very significant and serious and somewhat precipitous presentation that needs to be taken with a lot of concern if a patient who is on Bactrim treatment presents with pulmonary symptoms, and they need to be at a tertiary center if at all possible so that they can have the best chance of survival, because ECMO and transplantation and advanced respiration, it might not be available at all regional centers.
Terrifying.
Yes, nightmare fuel, but important for us to know about, and also important for our primary care colleagues to know about. Now, I'm happy that this was actually in a general literature article, general literature publication of sorts, as it is in the Journal of Pediatrics, not in Pediatric Dermatology, but I do think it's very helpful for us to be aware of it.
Well, of course, all medicines have extremely rare side effects. I had not heard about this one, and thanks to our listener, Dr. Monacy Ladrigan, she clued me into this issue and thought it was important to talk about, so thank you. And this is just yet more fuel to inspire us to move more quickly to isotretinoin rather than using antibiotics to treat acne. And I think, you know, I'm probably going to use doxycycline or clindamycin rather than trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole if I feel like I need to be treating cellulitis or something, so... It's scary. Of course, there's this recency bias. We just talked about it. It's a scary thing. I'm sure doxy and clinda can have their problems too. Toxic megacolon or whatever. But still, Bactrim just seems awfully suspicious.
We may have an exposure or sampling bias with our particular sentiment about Bactrim because we tend to hear about it when it's done something really bad. But I do think that there are other options. And personally, I get more angina from prescribing Bactrim than I do from prescribing Accutane on probably an order of magnitude scale.
Oh, yeah. Well,
yeah.
Well, still annoying, but not as bad as teenagers dying from antibiotics is your EHR inbox.
Almost as bad sometimes. I'm just kidding. People passing away is very serious, and we take that seriously.
But the inbox does suck. And this next article is about that. And it's not really a journal article. It's a publication from the AMA. And it's called A System Level Approach to EHR Inbox Reduction. 9 steps with practical examples from 3 organizations. The authors include Jane Fogg from Boston, C.T. Lin from UC Health in Colorado, and Christine Sinsky, who is the Vice President of Professional Satisfaction for the AMA. So a month or so ago, tried to send a message to one of my colleagues through the EHR, and I didn't hear back from him for a week or two, so I talked to one of his family members and was like, "Does he not like me?" And she said, "No, he likes you. He just doesn't like his in-basket." So that's fair. And all of these messages that we get in what's called the in-basket or the inbox or whatever, depending on your particular EHR, can create a lot of work for us, obviously. And studies have shown that messages increased during the pandemic, and they haven't decreased. Patients figured it out, and so how they get in touch with us now. So this article has a number of strategies to mitigate this particular issue, though most of them require a committee of high-level people to make changes to your EMR functionality. So if you're just like somebody living in a system and the system's probably not going to change, it's a little bit harder to implement some of this stuff, but some of it's still possible. This article is written from the standpoint of PCPs, so some of it's a little bit less relevant to us, but still, a small change multiplied across many patients can be a big win, as we've probably all noticed. And a lot of these, they talk about and make heavy use of the default option. So a nice little tie-in, Dr. Feldman. So they suggest that you begin by quantifying what sorts of messages you have of various types, which ones take up the most volume and which ones take the most time. So patient refill requests might take up the most, the sort of number of messages you get, but patient advice requests might take up more time. So they say try to quantify that stuff. And they say, if you're going to make this like an organizational change, make it a big deal. Have a committee with high-level executives, clinicians, nurses, medical assistants, IT people. Pay them. Might take some financial support because this is going to take a lot of people a lot of time. They say expect it to take at least a year to implement and then tweak it from there. They say they make a specific commitment or goal, like we're going to reduce in-basket messages by 25% without compromising patient care or something along those lines. And they say that if you're going to do this, a big action at the beginning, what they refer to as a grand gesture, can build credibility, buy-in, and optimism. So one option that one of these authors tried was to delete all messages across the EHR that were older than 6 months. Figure by 6 months, people have figured it out or it's become moot one way or another. They deleted these in the evening to avoid EMR slowdown because just the computer slowly deleting millions of messages can compromise functionality potentially. They say one hospital system took 3 weeks to delete 12 million messages.
Oh my God.
And then they changed all future messages to auto-delete after 3 months. Some of their recommendations have sort of catchy catchphrases like DC the CC. Discontinue CCing messages to people. This seems to be less of an issue for us, but I guess a lot of EMR systems automatically forward notes to the patient's PCP, so we might be sort of on the culprit end of this rather than the victim end. And apparently PCPs don't necessarily like this, and so they say consider changing your EMR to not automatically forward everything to the patient's PCP. Another catchphrase is 90x4, don't call me anymore. So this is related to refills. So if your patients request a refill and you think they're probably can get refills for a year, give them a 90-day supply at a time with 4 refills. And one of the small changes they made was to include 4 as a button, as an option for number of refills. Our EMR has 1, 2, 3, and 11. So we would have to actually change it to have a little 4 button. I've been giving people 90-day supply with 3 refills, but hey, 90 by 4 gives me another 3 months of no one calling me. Mm-hmm. And especially if it's fine. Like, there's so many things that are just fine to refill in dermatology. Also, they say delegating stuff to a support staff, like in a pool inbox. We do this at our institution, Michelle. I'm not sure if you guys do, but basically there's a Dr. Luke Johnson pool that my excellent MAs and other staff monitor all the time. And so they forward stuff. I never look at it, but they forward stuff to me from there if they think it needs my attention. But they're able to take care of a lot of that stuff.
There's like a first pass box that's covered, and then things that need the attending level attention get forwarded to them. I'm very grateful for my office support staff, the MAs and nurses that I work with, and my residents. They all do a really wonderful job helping to try to streamline some of this stuff.
Good. So it sounds like both of our institutions have done a decent job of creating this group and training them and creating a culture where they can handle as much as possible. These authors say, try to avoid people just forwarding it to you and saying, please advise. I guess it's nice to say please.
Yeah.
And they say, similarly, create a pool of peeps who can handle refill requests with guidelines about what can be refilled by these folks. I think we could do better about this, honestly. And it's probably better to try to make a change at the departmental level rather than me trying to institute some rule just because bigger bang for your buck. So I was thinking about this last night. Like, we could have a list of medicines where it's just, if they've seen me in the last year, it's fine to give them a year of ketoconazole shampoo or clindamycin lotion or hydrocortisone 2.5% ointment. Like, there's a list of at least half a dozen things that can just not meet, have me not look at it at all. I mean, I wouldn't do that even with things as minor as spironolactone and so on, probably, but still, there's things that could be. The authors advise that you create a coverage system when physicians are out. Shout out to Dr. Stephanie Klein here in our department who championed that a couple years ago. So now there's a nice system in place where when I'm on vacation, I know somebody else is going to be taking care of my patients and I can just completely forget about it. You got something like that where you are, Michelle?
Yes, we have a backup coverage system where things get forwarded to kind of our backup faculty when we're out.
You want to avoid burnout and take real vacations when you can. And they say so this is probably more relevant for PCPs, but it comes up with us sometimes, is lab work. So sometimes patients need labs to monitor their methotrexate or whatever. And so they suggest having the patient get the labs 2 or 3 days ahead of their visit so that when they come see you, the lab work is already done and you can review it with them, can help reduce physician workload because then you don't have to like see the labs afterward and call them or whatever. I did wonder if that was patient-centered though, because that forces the patient to go off and do something 3 days ahead of their appointment with you, whereas we draw labs in our clinic. So that seems more convenient for the patient. So I'm not quite sure about that one. What's your take on it?
I think that if it's a recurring thing where you can have the expectation that you're on this medication, I have to check labs every time we see you 3 days before your visit, go ahead and get your labs checked if that's feasible. I think that that does streamline some of the workflow. But of course, you know, we have to adjust for patient needs. I have a lot of patients that travel a long distance to see us here in beautiful, sunny Lubbock, Texas, because we're an island in a very kind of full but not very concentrated sea of people. And so we have a catchment area of about 400 miles. So some of my patients, for them to drive in 3 days before their appointment would be prohibitive. But when we can, we do try to streamline things.
Our EHR is epic, and it has a tab called Media, which is kind of a catch-all. There's a bunch of stuff that gets scanned in there and shows up in the Media tab. And maybe it's just too much of a catch-all. So these authors suggest adjusting it so, like, outside lab results, for example, that get scanned in, currently, they end up in our Media tab, but they should probably go to the Results tab or something instead. This next one, maybe, again, more appropriate for PCPs, but they suggest that any normal lab results and stuff just get automatically sent to the patient through the EMR portal so the clinicians don't have to see them at all. Dermatology could probably do a better job at this, too, especially with, like, our biopsy results. Part of the sort of pushback with making these available for patients all the time is because there's a bunch of medical jargon in there and a patient might be like, Nevus, whoa, that sounds scary. But we could probably do a job of like, our dermatopathologists have sort of standard phrases they use for various nevi, but they all boil down to not a big deal, don't worry about it. And so if we included some kind of language like that that got forwarded to the patient, then probably we don't necessarily have to see all these biopsy results.
That's an interesting thought. Like, there could be a framing put on, not on the report itself, because the report itself is its own document, but maybe something that goes around it where, you know, the results presented in this pathology report are benign and reassuring or something like that. I think that would be very reasonable. I would advocate that there be some kind of lock where, like, a melanoma result or something like that wouldn't be released to the patient before the physicians had a chance to counsel them, for three reasons. One of those is, when I was in residency, we had Epic, and I was at the Cleveland Clinic, and briefly they were doing auto releases like that. And a patient got their diagnosis of melanoma without being talked to by their physician and having that contextualized. It was a very superficial melanoma. The patient's wife called me telling me that he was suicidal because of his diagnosis, and I had to try to get a hold of him in an emergency situation. And it was just that the pathology report had just been released. He'd accessed it. We hadn't sat on it or anything, but he had a very strong reaction to the diagnosis. So for anything that could be life-changing, I do think that some kind of protective block before the patient can just see the results without any kind of physician guidance may be prudent. But for a benign result, I think that potentially an auto release for a set of benign diagnoses with framing that says this finding is benign and reassuring and does not require further treatment could be useful.
Agreed. And then one final note they make is to automate lab results so they all come in at once. I don't know if you've had this issue where you order like five labs on somebody and then you get this result. Look, their CBC is back. And you're like, okay. And you look through it all and you say, okay, fine. And then, oh, wait, we're still waiting on their TSH and their CMP. So then you just have to sit on it for a while.
It's that trickle. It kills you.
So those are some of the tips they advocate for. And I think some of them sound good. And some of them are things that you can do if you're just hanging out by yourself, figuring stuff out. And some of them would require sort of a big committee to change the whole system. But if you do change the whole system, it can save a lot of people a lot of time, again, without compromising patient care is the goal. And I'm always a fan of streamlining our use of technology.
Well, and something to emphasize anytime we talk around this space, because I don't want it to just sound like we're just being lazy and we don't want to look at all this stuff. There's also exposure saturation that happens with these things, where you can miss an important message because your inbox is full of dreck, right? So if you have something significant that's buried in a stack of insignificant things, the likelihood that that important thing gets the attention that it needs decreases. And so removing some of this white noise actually allows us to focus on and take better care of and more prompt care of those patients who really need our acute intervention.
For sure. You talked about medical records in a previous podcast and how the average patient's record has like 2/3 of the words of Shakespeare or something like that.
Yeah.
It's just too much. And they do have some funny quotes in here, including, many messages don't contain useful information.
Exactly. Yes.
It's true. So why are we bothering looking at them?
And I think that's one of the things, as we step into the brave new world of AI, that can hopefully be a good use of that technology, which is helping to potentially highlight urgent messages, as well as helping to filter non-urgent ones and helping us to focus on those things that we really need to have our attention on.
Well, at this point, Michelle, let's take a pause. A menopause.
A pause for the cause for the menopause miniseries. So this is part two of the three-part miniseries on the fascinating topic of menopause. Not exactly the most cheerful subject for a lady to review, because it's kind of, I'll just put it this way. Nature is sexist. Men burn more calories when they exercise. Not fair. They have an easier time losing weight in general and a harder time gaining it. And then the whole everything around the space of being a lady who is reproductively capable is challenging sometimes. But I think understanding it better helps us to ameliorate the symptoms of the transition that can occur for women, as well as helping our patients understand how to best take care of their changing body. So we previously covered some of the things that happen in menopause. I actually got some feedback from some of our listeners that reached out to me on social media and such, saying, wow, menopause sounds like super fun. And I think that that sentiment is understandable. I think in informing ourselves and arming ourselves with knowledge and understanding as to how the changes happen and what we can do about them can be empowering. So in this second part of the menopause miniseries, we are going to discuss the fact that the skin is an endocrine organ and the way that the hormones in our body affect the skin. So our skin cells do produce sex hormones and other steroids such as estrogens, androgens, and glucocorticoids from systemic steroid hormones that originate in the adrenals. And in menopause, changes of sex hormones can occur. The androstenedione sex hormone binding globulin ratio, cortisol, melatonin, insulin-like growth factor, and norepinephrine are also related to the pathophysiology of menopause and also change during this time. And of course, we also think about the exposome, which we've spoken about previously in the podcast, that includes all of the things that our body and skin is exposed to. And so, of course, in addition to the hormonal changes and the effects of chronological aging, sun exposure and other environmental or lifestyle factors can affect menopausal skin biology. As we discussed in the previous part of this mini series, patients actually went through an experiment where they did UV radiation for patients who are menopausal or not menopausal, and then actually looked at skin pigmentation change and found that there was greater skin pigmentation change in patients who were menopausal with the same level of sun exposure as patients who were not menopausal. So you had more skin changes develop in patients who had those hormonal changes. The chief hormone we always think about with menopause is estrogen. Hypoestrogenism can affect various systems. It's important in immune function, cancer development, and health and well-being. Estrogens, especially 17-beta-estradiol, are synthesized in the ovaries in premenopausal women. Estrone comes from non-ovarian sites in menopausal women, including the adrenal glands, skin, brain, adipose tissue, and pancreas. And human skin is a major target of hormones. Glucocorticoids, as we know, affect the skin. We've all seen the changes the glucocorticoids can present with on the skin. Cyclic AMP analogs, growth factors, and cytokines all modulate local estrogen synthetase via aromatase, which is expressed in the pilosebaceous unit. And one of the reasons why sometimes our therapeutics for hair follicle-related diseases are actually sort of like bouncers for the hair follicle that help the hair follicle not be affected by hormones. So our finasteride, our spironolactone, sometimes dutasteride is used. If you're going the natural pathway, saw palmetto is
Don't forget bicalutamide.
And bicalutamide.
Recently.
Yes, bicalutamide, which is presenting as a novel potential option for the treatment of hair loss, as we previously discussed in episode 107. Was it 107?
It was 100. Pretty sure it was 107.
I think it was 107, but I'm not 100% sure. Okay. Estrogen receptors are abundant in the dermis and the epidermis, and there are actually studies that look at women's facial features over their menstrual cycle and in the hyperestrogenic portions of the menstrual cycle, so the first part of the menstrual cycle, women's features actually appear more symmetric and the face appears more full than in the second half of the menstrual cycle. The second half of the menstrual cycle is a little bit more like the hormonal profile of menopause. And when I was thinking about this, I was like, good Lord, all of this is just nature trying to make babies, because like women actually look better when they're reproductively capable. So like the facial symmetry increases and the fullness increases in the kind of pre-ovulatory portions of the menstrual cycle when it's more likely a woman will get pregnant. And so I think a lot of these changes are just nature trying to make more babies because, you know, genes want to reproduce themselves. The estrogen receptors in the dermis and the epidermis are probably responsible for some of those measured changes that have been reported in the literature. There's also, of course, estrogen receptors in the genitalia. In the skin, the receptors are most frequently seen in the face and also, interestingly, in the lower limbs. In human skin, there's no gender difference in the pattern of distribution of estrogen receptors, which is why trans women, when they're given estrogen therapy, start to look so much more feminized because the estrogen receptors are exerting their activity in the receptors that are there, just not being activated before the hormone therapy. And there are two isoforms of estrogen receptor alpha and estrogen receptor beta. A large number of natural and synthetic estrogens can have similar binding affinity to both receptors, but some ligands are more selective. So there's genistein and diadazine, which are stronger on estrogen receptor beta than estrogen receptor alpha. Estrogen receptor alpha is present in basal and partially differentiated cells of the sebaceous glands. It's only present in a small proportion of eccrine glands and epithelia. And in the axillary apocrine glands, there's strong nuclear expression of estrogen receptor alpha in the secretory epithelium. Estrogen receptor beta is in sebaceous glands in the same distribution as estrogen receptor alpha, and it's also in human eccrine sweat glands. So if you were looking to affect the eccrine sweat glands, you'd probably want to influence estrogen receptor beta. It is widely expressed in the skin in the dermal papilla cells, dermal fibroblasts, sebacytes, adipocytes, melanocytes, and keratinocytes, as well as the outer root sheath, which is probably one of the areas that takes a hit in estrogen deprivation states and causes some of the hair shaft thinning that we can observe in later menopause. The impact of estrogen decline has been extensively reviewed, and estrogen deficiency during menopause can alter skin functions, including impairing skin barrier function, causing skin dryness due to diminished skin moisture and decreased sebum production, decreased antioxidant function, and impaired wound healing. And decreased collagen and elastin synthesis can also lead to dermal wrinkling and thinning on the skin and genital mucosa, as well as decreased glycosaminoglycans in the extracellular matrix, leading to decreased skin turgescence, or the turgidity of skin, that sort of bounce back of young, healthy skin, and reduced hydration. Thermoregulatory function can also be decreased. Patients can present with pallor, reduced vascularity, and there can also be the hot flashes caused by vasodilatation. Estradiol can also affect the growth and life cycle of hair follicles by binding to the estrogen receptors, influencing the aromatase activity, which is responsible for converting androgens into estrogens. Estradiol also prolongs the anagen phase of the hair cycle, enhancing hair growth by increasing the synthesis of the growth factors in the follicular keratinocytes. And this is one of the reasons we believe that hair growth after menopause can decrease. And estrogen also induces glycogen production by vaginal and cervical epithelial cells. Menopausal decline in estrogen can cause urogenital atrophy, loss of vaginal epithelial cells, and a loss of mucosal moisture. There's also potentially a decrease in the production of antimicrobial and anti-inflammatory signals, which can lead to increased susceptibility to mucosal injury. And this is one of the reasons why I typically will use a compounded estrogen testosterone cream on the vaginal mucosa of patients who are suffering from lichen sclerosis, because it can help to provide a little bit more of a sort of trophic effect on that mucosa. Now, androgens also have effect in menopause. Unlike estrogen and progesterone, which decline rapidly, androgen secretion is already relatively low in women, and it declines very gradually with menopause. It can modulate hair growth and sebum production, and basically it makes postmenopausal women look more like a male type phenotype that has that androgen receptor sensitivity that we would have described with the Gabrin sign in patients with COVID. So we talked about in COVID, patients who had male pattern alopecia could and a lot of like hirsutism could be more susceptible to COVID because the TMPRSS2 kind of access was part of the way that the virus gained access into cells. And so patients who had that sensitivity were more vulnerable to COVID. That phenotype where there's more hair on the body or on the lower face, less hair on the scalp, and hypersebaceous secretion can present itself in menopause as well due to the relative predominance of male type hormones. And it really is that ratio that can make a difference. So many women who will present with those findings will not be systemically hyperandrogen, but the ratios of androgen to estrogen have been significantly altered. And then DHEA, which is sometimes supplemented by people who are doing like biohacking or bodybuilding, or DHEAS, which is just sulfated. This is produced in the adrenal glands, and it is sort of a pro-hormone. It can be converted in sebacytes to testosterone, and then it can be converted in all skin epithelial cells to 5-alpha-dihydrotestosterone, which, as we know, is the naughty hormone that causes male pattern alopecia. The aromatization of the androgens can also lead to the synthesis of skin-active estrogens, such as estradiol and estrones, and more potent androgens have more of an impact on the skin. So these are things that can affect the hormone axis. DHEA is the cardinal source of both androgen and estrogen synthesis in all tissues except the uterus following menopause. And supplementation has been shown to increase skin thickness, hydration, and sebum production. Local synthesis of sex steroids in the skin can also affect the eccrine glands and hair follicles. Now, DHEA can be a double-edged sword because it is a it's a precursor for both testosterone and estrogen. In people who are already hyperandrogenic in menopause, if you add DHEA or DHEAS, you may push on that access more and cause more hair loss unless you're blocking the DHT in one way or another. So I actually, in my pie in the sky, I can do anything research like fantasies. I want to study supplementing DHEAS with a 5-alpha reductase inhibitor on board to like see if you could get the benefits of DHEA without the side effects. Cortisol, as we know, also affects the skin. We know that that comes from our adrenal glands and it increases with stress. Stress hormones negatively affect our barrier. They actually suppress the pro-inflammatory cytokines IL-1 and TNF-alpha. We use that intentionally as a therapeutic with corticosteroids with inflammatory disease, but those are an important part of skin repair. And when they're completely decreased, as they can be in menopause, you can have deficient cutaneous repair, and that can cause dryness, inflammation, and wrinkles. The cortisol levels can also increase in the late stages of perimenopause, especially in women who have severe hot flashes. And norepinephrine can also increase, which can hamper hair growth and can potentially also cause vasoconstriction and skin dryness. Vitamin D is an important hormonal type vitamin that is both available in the metabolite of 25-hydroxy-D2, which is from plant sources, and 25-hydroxy-D3, which is from animal products, or is synthesized in the skin. The prevalence of vitamin D insufficiency is more common in older patients. Vitamin D supplementation has not been shown to affect overall health outcomes in several clinical studies, but vaginal health outcomes in menopausal women with vulvovaginal atrophy symptoms have been shown. And so this is one of the things I check and supplement in my patients with lichen sclerosis. And it's also important when you're looking at a patient that has metabolic syndrome risk profiles, because those patients can benefit more from vitamin D. Interestingly, in menopausal women, calcifediol was found to be superior to cholecalciferol, which is one of the more common supplements for improving vitamin D status. And that's being marketed specifically as a vitamin D improving medication for women. And it also may have some correlation with muscle strength. And then finally, melatonin, it declines with menopause and or aging. The concentrations of the melatonin decreasing in menopause may be part of the pathophysiology of the vasomotor symptoms, mood and sleep disorders that can affect the quality of life in patients in menopause. So stay tuned for part 3 of the menopause miniseries, in which we will discuss what we can do about all of this. So prevention, management, and treatment of these symptoms. So please stay tuned and stay hopeful. There are options and there are things that we can do to help arm our patients to better take care of themselves in this time.
What a cliffhanger.
I know. Got to stay tuned for part 3.
We should discuss. Mentioned that this is from the article called Skin, Hair, and Beyond, The Impact of Menopause, which is published in a journal called Climacteric. The authors include Dr. Zubelis and Goldstein, among others. And it's also probably important to point out that there is a conflict of interest. This is basically made by a company that produces products intended to be used by postmenopausal women.
But stay tuned for the next episode, like Snoop Dogg would say.
He would say that?
Yeah, it's at the end of Nothing But a G Thing, isn't it? So stay tuned for the next episode.
You are more of a Snoop Dogg lore expert than I am. I am possibly more of an expert in pediatric dermatology than I am in Snoop Dogg. So I want to talk about atopic dermatitis and dupilumab. So this is from the JAD. It's called Dupilumab Treatment for Atopic Dermatitis is Associated with Decreased Utilization of Psychostimulants for Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder, a Retrospective Cohort Study. The authors include Amit Yildirim, Tania Pradhan, and Zachary Zinn. And these folks are out of West Virginia University. So, atopic dermatitis has been associated with ADHD, Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder. And this study here is a big data study using millions of patient records from a big commercial database called TrinetX. I think we've previously discussed a couple other articles that use this database.
Yes, Scott. I'm actually trying to get my institution to be a part of this database. So you have to kind of opt into it. And that means you're sharing your data with it. But if you opt in, then you have access to all of the data and can do research on it, is my understanding. So I'm working with my institution to try to get that to happen.
Well, there's lots of stuff you could do if you have millions of patient records, including look at this particular issue. So they tried to examine whether or not dupilumab might be associated with improvements in ADHD symptomatology. So they used a surrogate, which was the use of psychostimulants or nootropic medications. Mm-hmm. So for the NIH, a nootropic is, quote, a diverse group of medicinal substances whose action improves human thinking, learning, and memory.
I like
Sounds pretty good. Mm-hmm. Give me some nootropic activities. But I guess it's especially if those are deficient. So if you're, you know, if you have ADHD and you have trouble focusing, then a nootropic might help you focus. Mm-hmm. So they found 56,000 patients who had diagnoses of both AD, atopic dermatitis, and ADHD. 56,000, I'm rounding here, but that's a lot of people. About 1,000 of them were treated with dupilumab and 55,000 weren't, so they were able to compare those two groups. And those treated with dupilumab were less likely to have one of those types of medication prescribed. Cool. At least if they were male. So relative risk, we've discussed that before. So the relative risk for all of these people was 0.85 when it came to, again, prescriptions for psychostimulants and nootropics. So basically, you had an 85% chance compared to 100%, if you will, of having one of these things prescribed for you if you were on dupilumab. For males, the relative risk was 0.75. For females, though, it was basically 1. So did not seem to be statistically significant for female patients. But they also compared patients before and after dupilumab being prescribed for the first time. And after that, prescriptions for psychostimulants and nootropic medications decreased. So the relative risk dropped to 0.72 among all comers, for males 0.67, and for females 0.77. So it decreased among everybody there. So if you've got a patient with atopic dermatitis and ADHD, if you prescribe them the dupilumab, they seem to get less prescriptions for their ADHD medications. That's cool. Mm-hmm. They speculate that perhaps your ADHD improves because dupilumab makes you less itchy and you sleep better, which makes a lot of sense to me. Mm-hmm. Limitations: the severity of these patients' atopic dermatitis was not noted, nor were the reasons for prescribing any of these medications. So perhaps some people were being prescribed psychostimulants and nootropics for reasons other than ADHD, and perhaps they were being prescribed dupilumab for something else, maybe for their asthma, for example, though they did have diagnoses of both atopic dermatitis and ADHD. So you might consider using this in your letters to insurance companies, trying to convince them to prescribe dupilumab for your patients, especially your patients with ADHD, or perhaps even other psychiatric comorbidities as well. You can also use it if you're trying to convince your patients that dupilumab is a good idea for them, which it usually is, unless it's, you know, cost prohibitive. So we tend to like dupilumab a lot on this podcast. I mean, the main problem is it's pretty expensive, and here's another way in which it helps our patients. Pretty cool.
Yeah, I think that whenever the mechanism of action for dupilumab was first described, I was like, oh, this is going to be useful for a lot of things. And I was like, oh, this is going to get hard to get. Because the biologics for psoriasis, we're looking at a 2 to max maybe 4% of the population. But when you talk about atopic diathesis, they're so much more common. And so the possible utility of a medication that impacts that access is much more broad, which is wonderful on one hand, because that means we have this tool that's very safe that we can use to treat a lot of patients quite effectively. The hard part is figuring out how to cover the cost of it. And that's something that we as a healthcare system and as a culture and nation really need to try to come up with some better answers for. I think one of the things that would help would be to not have a for-profit insurance company like system, or at least to regulate some of it, because even during one of the most stressed times on our healthcare system to the memory, during the COVID pandemic, they were still having like multiple million-dollar bonuses for their CEOs and significant gains in stock and things like that during a period where everybody else was on sort of austerity measures. And I think that the lack of regulation of the insurance industry is a significant problem and needs to be addressed.
Vote for Michelle Tarbox for Congress. What if dupilumab was 10 times cheaper, but 10 times as many people were on it? Would that appease all of these companies?
Well, the company that makes it, I'm not sure how we can talk them into that. But, you know, the thing with biologics, too, that has to be considered is there's a lot of risk in making these drugs. They're very powerful. They are able to bypass a lot of the normal safety mechanisms of the human body. So we have to always take that into consideration. And there's a lot of cost in drug development. There's also cost in manufacture. I do think that the prices of these drugs in other countries might be a good bellwether for what the market forces can tolerate. And I think that collaboration between lawmakers and those people who are actually taking care of patients. And in that, I do include the pharmaceutical industry because they help to develop the medications we use to help our patients get better. I think that those primary stakeholders need to be part of the dialogue on how to make this more equitable and available to patients.
Well, thanks for hanging out with us today, guys. That is all we have time for. So today we welcomed Steve Feldman back on to talk about the default option. We also talked about how terrifyingly trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole can occasionally kill otherwise healthy teenagers through respiratory problems. That's not good. We learned some tricks about how to reduce your EHR inbox volume. We learned that it sucks to be a woman. Sorry, guys. Thanks for perpetuating the human species, but menopause doesn't sound like fun. And we learned that dupilumab can potentially improve ADHD symptoms in your patients with atopic dermatitis. Thanks very much for hanging out with us. And thanks, of course, to our institutions. Thanks to the University of Utah for supporting the podcast. And thank you to Texas Tech for lending us Michelle. Thanks also to Team Dermasphere, our group of enthusiastic medical students who keep various aspects of the podcast moving along. They include Morgan Dykman, Guy Kusecki, Eleonora Marcacci, Michael Birdsall, Aparna Nayak, Neha Deo, Haley Walsh, Angie Wong, and Lara Dela Cruz. Thanks so much for everything you guys do. One thing you guys do is keep our social media accounts moving, so you can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You also keep our website updated. You can find us on dermaspherepodcast.com, which also has links to all of the original articles and is a good way to get in touch with us as well. In addition, another thing Team Dermasphere does for us is create the video content I mentioned earlier. You can find us on ViewMedi now. There are some PowerPoint-style productions to go along with the podcast. And as a reminder, come to Idaho in September to hang out with me for the Practical Dermatology for Primary Care course and or the Intermountain Dermatology Society meeting.
That's and just all. Chill.
Go ahead.
I was just going to quote Snoop Dogg and say, and just chill till the next episode.